KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Tom, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do.
After President Trump moved forward with steep tariffs on China, Mexico, and Canada, the countries say they'll retaliate.
It's Tuesday, March 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Trump will address a joint session of Congress tonight where he'll take stock of what he's accomplished.
We speak with an immigration lawyer who represents some people that the administration is targeting for deportation.
I feel that he was just moving way faster than I anticipated. But at the end of the day, there are still rights and he's not about the law.
And what does vaporizing minerals in Algeria have to do with the search for life on Mars?
Mars is a screenshot of the early Earth. Of course, not exactly, but quite similar.
That's coming up, but first, these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. When President Trump delivers the first joint address to Congress of his second term, he'll be speaking to a deeply divided America. Trump is expected to talk about immigration and border security along with the economy. But as NPR's Mara Liasson explains, high prices remain something that's been a stubborn sticking point.
People voted for him because they didn't like inflation. He promised to bring prices down, and he was very explicit about it. But since he's been in office, he has backed off from those promises. He's talked about how hard it is to bring down prices. And what I'm watching for tonight is how he talks about something that he hasn't prioritized, but that we know voters are very concerned about, because polling shows more than half of Americans think Trump is not doing enough to bring down prices.
Some Democrats angered over Trump's drastic approach to government downsizing say they will not attend tonight's speech. A number of other Democrats say they'll wear blue and yellow to show their support for Ukraine. After President Trump delivers his address tonight to the joint session of Congress, Democrats will get their chance to weigh in. NPR's Don Gagne reports Michigan Senator Alyssa Slotkin will give the party response.
Slotkin is new to the Senate after representing a Michigan U.S. House district that leans Republican for three terms. A centrist Democrat with a resume that includes time as a CIA intelligence analyst during both the George W. Bush and Barack Obama presidencies, she campaigned last year saying Americans are tired of divisive politics and said she's ready to reach across the aisle. Still, she has delivered pointed criticism of Trump administration policies, including the firings of federal workers, tariffs, which she says will hurt U.S. automakers, and the president's Oval Office berating of Ukrainian President Zelensky. Don Gagne, NPR News.
The Texas measles outbreak continues with an increase in confirmed cases this week. Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Alcorta Solorio reports.
The number of confirmed cases has risen to 159 from last week's update of 146. The outbreak is still isolated to West Texas. Out of the total number of cases, 5 are vaccinated, the rest are not, or their status is unknown. The majority of the cases are in Gaines County, where the outbreak is centered. So far, one death has resulted from the outbreak, a school-aged unvaccinated child who lived in the area of the outbreak. For NPR News, I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
According to the Vatican, Pope Francis is in stable condition, has been breathing with just the help of supplemental oxygen after suffering more respiratory crises yesterday. According to doctors, the pontiff continues to try to recover from a case of double pneumonia. Francis will apparently wear a non-invasive mechanical ventilation mask. Doctors say the Pope's prognosis remains guarded. Stocks plunged on Wall Street today. The Dow fell 670 points. This is NPR. Mamma Mia, the popular jukebox musical featuring ABBA songs, is returning to Broadway for a 6-month run starting in August. The original production ran for over 14 years and became a film with a sequel, Jeff London reports.
Mamma Mia opened on Broadway in October of 2001, a little over a month after the 9/11 terror attacks. And its mixture of pop tunes and an escapist story set on a Greek island proved irresistible to audiences. It ran for 5,773 performances, making it the 9th longest running show in Broadway history. After 10 years away and numerous productions around the world and on cruise ships, it's coming back. Producer Judy Kramer told the New York Times it celebrates women, it's about second chances, it's about hope, and it's not political. It brings audiences together. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The state of Minnesota says it intends to crack down on sites and apps that help people to create and distribute so-called deepfake pornography. A bill making its way through the state legislature there targets so-called nudification websites that allow people to upload photos of someone to generate a sexually explicit image or video. It's one of the ongoing strategies lawmakers are taking or trying to crack down on. In many cases, there already are bans on dissemination of such sexually explicit images. Crude oil futures prices fell to multi-month lows today as markets try to adjust to the Trump tariffs. Oil down 11 cents a barrel to $68.26 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the early hours this morning, after all the threats, taunts, and last-minute climb-downs, the Trump administration slapped 25% tariffs on imports from America's two biggest trading partners, Mexico and Canada. Now, China was also at the receiving end of a further 10% tariff on goods, adding to the 10% imposed last month. Both Canada and China hit back with retaliatory tariffs. Mexico promised to follow suit in the coming days. Wall Street immediately reacted, and the stock market tanked for a second day in a row when it opened this morning. Joining us to talk about the impact is NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam and NPR's Eder Peralta in Mexico City. Hi to both of you.
Hey, Juan.
Hi. Good to be here. Thanks.
Jackie, I'll start with you. What was Canada's response?
Well, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau immediately pledged that Canada would impose retaliatory tariffs. He said 25% import taxes would be placed on about $100 billion of U.S. products, and that'll be rolled out over the next 3 weeks. And there are also threats to withhold Canadian crude oil and hydroelectricity to some U.S. industries. You know, Canada has been bracing for these tariffs ever since Trump first threatened to unveil them a month ago. And still during, you know, a lengthy press conference today, Trudeau seemed incredulous that Trump went ahead with them.
The United States launched a trade war against Canada, their closest partner and ally, their closest friend. At the same time, they're talking about working positively with Russia, appeasing Vladimir Putin, a lying, murderous dictator. Make that make sense.
And, you know, Trudeau warned that Trump's decision to place steep tariffs on the country will cause Canadians a lot of economic pain, and he urged them to stay strong and united.
Eder, over to you. Mexico's Claudia Sheinbaum has also been talking. What has she had to say?
I mean, it was a different approach. The strategy for Mexico has been to try to keep calm. They have tried not to antagonize President Trump. Even today, President Claudia Sheinbaum gave a very sober speech. She said President Trump was breaking a free trade deal he signed himself. She said this unilateral move was senseless and said there was no reason to do this.
Es tiempo de la defensa de México y su soberanía. Debemos estar atentos y tener tranquilidad, cabeza fría.
It's time to defend Mexico, she said. We have to be poised, but we also have to keep a cool head. And to that end, she did not announce any retaliatory measures. Instead, she called on Mexicans to show up at the Zócalo, which is the main square here in Mexico City, on Sunday, where she would announce how Mexico would respond. But what you get the feeling is that she delayed responding in order to try to talk to President Trump and try to get these tariffs removed before Sunday.
Well, as both of these leaders have said, there are no winners in a trade war. So what's likely to be the impact on both sides of the border? Eder, you first.
I mean, economists here are saying recession. One economist said that it feels like the beginning of the pandemic. No one knows what's coming or how long it will last. 80% of Mexico's exports go to the United States. Mexico is the United States' biggest trading partner. We're talking billions and billions of dollars in trade, everything from fuel to cars to electronics to plastic to cereals to avocados. Prices will rise in both countries, and we may see mass layoffs. Octavio de la Torre, the president of Concanaco, a conglomerate of chambers of commerce, says the U.S. stock markets are reacting negatively for a reason.
Porque hay un efecto que no puedes tú nada más ubicar en territorio mexicano. La economía se encuentra integrada.
You can't isolate the effect only to Mexico, he said, because American companies are doing a ton of work here. For example, one of the biggest exporters here in Mexico is General Motors, an American car manufacturer.
And Jackie, what about in Canada? What's the likely impact there?
Well, economists and analysts are predicting that this could send Canada into a recession as well. No one knows how long it's going to last. And Trudeau's talked about extending unemployment insurance for workers and helping businesses hard hit by tariffs. But, you know, there's already talk of seeing higher costs and contracts being canceled. Some provinces are going beyond federal efforts to retaliate. For example, Ontario canceled a $100 million contract with Starlink, and that's Elon Musk's satellite internet company.
Well, I mean, as we already mentioned, these two countries are the U.S.'s biggest trading partners. But Jackie, looking beyond trade for a moment, what's the likely knock-on effect?
Yeah, I mean, Canada feels it was more than a trading partner. It was a longtime ally, and now that's shattered. And, you know, effectively, this is Trudeau's last week in office, and I think he may have felt free to go out on a limb. At a press conference, he suggested that Trump's real goal is to collapse Canada's economy so the U.S. could annex the country. And at one point, Juana, Trudeau addressed Trump directly. He looked directly straight into the camera and called him by his first name as he referred to a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal.
Donald, they point out that even though you're a very smart guy, this is a very dumb thing to do.
And no surprise, Trump responded dismissively, calling him Governor Trudeau and threatening more tariffs likely next month.
Ader, I'll let you have the last word here. What about in Mexico?
I mean, look, this Mexican-American partnership has not been easy to build. These are two countries that have been at war. Mexico lost half its territory to the United States. And one thing that the Mexican president keeps saying is that this partnership, which has been forged for the past 30 years or so, is in the end a good thing. It has meant a robust Mexican economy. It means the countries are living peacefully in what has become the biggest market in the world. And now it seems President Trump is throwing that away. And the Mexican president is already talking about finding new markets. So the question is, do these tariffs stick around long enough for Mexico to turn away from North America? Do these tariffs stick around long enough to undo what has become a special relationship between Mexico and the U.S.? And the big question is, does this mark an end to globalism?
That is NPR's Ader Peralta and Jackie Northam. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
Nearly 40% of white evangelical Protestants now support same-sex marriage rights. That's one of the findings of a new survey from the Public Religion Research Institute. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose reports.
According to PRRI's American Values Atlas, more than two-thirds of Americans now favor the right for same-sex couples to marry. The survey found an increase in the share of people from more conservative religious backgrounds who favor marriage equality. 38% of white evangelical Protestants now support same-sex marriage rights, up from 28% a decade ago. The survey also found that most Americans think it's wrong for businesses to refuse service to LGBTQ customers based on the owner's religious beliefs, something that mostly shows up around wedding services like baking cakes. But PRRI's Melissa Deckman says Republicans are becoming more likely to favor allowing such refusals.
There's been a trend in recent years for them to litigate on the behalf of these business owners as a matter of what they view as religious freedom.
Meanwhile, LGBTQ people have been disaffiliating from faith groups. 52% don't consider themselves part of any religion. Deckman says the survey found 28% of all U.S. adults to be religiously unaffiliated.
We've often asked in the past, why are people disaffiliating from religion? And we find that more Americans than ever cite treatment of LGBTQ individuals by their religious faith traditions as a reason they do so.
PRRI found among the more than 22,000 U.S. adults surveyed, the country is evenly divided on laws banning gender-affirming care for minors.
It's not merely that Republicans have become so much more in favor of these sorts of laws, but we see it among Democrats and independents alike.
Deckman attributes this split in part to fewer people knowing a transgender person than knowing someone in a same-sex relationship. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
You know this song.
I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
The singer and songwriter Dolly Parton, the man in question, her husband Carl Thomas Dean, and the woman with flaming locks of auburn hair was inspired by two different redheads.
One was a young girl, maybe 8 years old, who asked for Dolly Parton's autograph after a show. She gave her name as Jolene. The other was a tall, leggy bank teller, as Parton told NPR in 2008.
She got this terrible crush on my husband, and he just loved going to the bank because she paid him so much attention. It was kind of like a running joke between us when I was saying, hell, you're spending a lot of time at the bank. I don't believe we've got that kind of money. So it's really an innocent song all around, but sounds like a dreadful one.
I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
Dolly Parton has announced that her husband, Carl Dean, died on Monday, March 3rd. They were together for more than 60 years.
The couple met at a laundromat on the day Parton moved to Nashville, Tennessee. Parton described the moment in 1977 on NBC's The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
Anyway, we met at the wishy-washy, and in all honesty, it's been wishy-washy ever
since. The wishy-washy? That's
yeah. And 2 years later, we married.
Carl Dean was almost never in the spotlight. For all of her stardom, Dolly Parton kept her personal life quite private. But back in 2023, I got to talk to the country music legend about her album of classic rock songs, and she told me that while she rarely bothered her husband with her music, she sought his ear for this project.
And then when it was all over, he said, well, I have to say, that's pretty damn good. And so for him to say that would be like somebody else jumping up and down, you know, with pom-poms, and saying that's the best thing I ever heard. But to me, for him to say, I have to say, that's pretty damn good. That was all I needed to hear because I knew he liked it.
In a statement, Dolly Parton wrote, Carl and I spent many wonderful years together. Words can't do justice to the love we shared for over 60 years. Carl Thomas Dean was 82 years old.
Jolene, 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 Jolene. Because you can. Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A few days before President Trump took over the White House for the second time, I got back in touch with someone I met years ago during the first Trump administration.
My name is Andrea Lino, and I am an immigration lawyer.
She's based in Seattle with clients in a bunch of Western states.
I represent individuals who are detained in immigration custody.
Immigration was the central focus of Donald Trump's presidential campaign.
When I'm reelected, we will begin, and we have no choice, the largest deportation operation in American history. We have no.
Tonight, he'll address Congress and the nation in a major speech where he'll sum up what he's accomplished in his first month. I wanted to know what that month has felt like to someone far outside Washington, D.C., who represents some of the people the administration is targeting for deportation. So I occasionally checked in with Andrea Lino over these last weeks, starting in mid-January, just before Inauguration Day.
I've seen that no knowing what's going to happen, it's scary.
She told me the worst part was the uncertainty.
But at the same time, I feel that I am in the right place. So I feel pretty privileged to be able to use my work and my knowledge to make people feel safer.
Before Trump was sworn in, Lino was spending time calming people down and educating them.
I say there is going to be a lot of action. There is going to be a lot of executive orders that sound very scary, but that doesn't mean that is going to happen.
So you're telling people don't believe everything you hear.
Exactly. Don't believe everything you hear. I feel that what they want is like, a lot of people get self-deported because they are afraid.
I could imagine someone in your position feeling like, oh no, not this again. Or, this is what I trained for. This is what I live for. Bring it on. Where are you on a scale between those two emotions?
Oh no, I feel more like, no, this not again. I try to like, to have hope in humanity, but I am feeling pretty tired, and it's not like a great feeling to start for years. And so I am ready to fight. I have the energy, but I feel sad for what is about to happen.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
During Donald Trump's first week in office, he signed dozens of executive orders, and many were about immigration.
Today is January 27, Monday.
Exactly 1 week after mm-hmm. President Trump took the oath of office.
Correct.
What's the week been like for you?
Oof, it feels that it has been a year. It's just a lot. I don't know where to even start.
Andrea Lino told me about one client of hers in Denver. He was getting cancer treatment. A friend picked him up from chemo, and they stopped at a Walmart on the way home. The friend went into the store while the client stayed in the car. Then the client called Andrea and said, immigration agents are in Walmart arresting people.
So all that I was telling him is that, well, you remain in the car. The car is your premise, so you don't open the door unless they have a warrant for your arrest. And my client was obviously pretty overwhelmed and upset, and the friend had the keys for the car. So after a lot of waiting, the friend came outside. And my understanding is that they arrested just one person, and it was because the person ran. And it's like the first thing that we tell people is that you don't have to run, because then you are giving them a reason, right, to arrest you.
When we asked the Denver Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement about this incident, they told us, quote, due to our operational tempo and the increased interest in our agency, we are not able to research and respond to rumors or specifics of routine daily operations. In that first week of the Trump presidency, Lino did not see mass arrests or a spike in deportations. What she saw was panic, and she thinks that was deliberate.
I feel that he was just moving way faster than I anticipated. But at the end of the day, there are still rights, and he's not above the law, and his administration is not above the law. But it's definitely making our job harder, and it's making people panic.
Some of her clients have been scared enough to self-deport, and the Trump administration has specifically said that's one of their goals.
Leave now. If you don't, we will find you, and we will deport you. You will never return.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem delivered this message in a video on her department's YouTube page.
Follow the law, and you'll find opportunity. Break it, and you'll find consequences. The choice is yours. America.
Today is February 24th, 2025.
Does it now feel like the dust has settled a little bit, or is there still that sense of chaos and uncertainty?
I think that there has been so many other distractions from this administration that is affecting also other people now, not just immigrants, but also, I mean, federal workers, you know, transgender individuals, that the focus is not just immigration. So that feels kind of a relief in a weird way, because I also know that a lot of other people are like suffering.
Andrea Lino told me her organization, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, did have a big victory in the last month. When the ACLU went to court challenging Trump's executive order aimed at ending birthright citizenship, they needed to find people who would actually be harmed by the policy.
Undocumented women who are currently pregnant and about to have a child in the United States.
And so that included some of your clients.
That included, some of our clients, correct.
So when the judge issued the ruling, siding with your clients, what was that day like for you?
It was great. You know, it was like, okay, at least there is like, we can believe again in check and balances, you know. But at the same time, I feel like I just worried for what's going to happen once that it goes to the Supreme Court, because I do not have a lot of faith in the Supreme Court anymore.
But at least for one day, you could exhale.
Yeah, exactly.
The big pattern she's seen in the last month, not major workplace raids or neighborhood sweeps. Instead, it's a lot of traffic stops.
What we call driving while black or brown, basically. They just follow those people, stop them, and ask them where they are from, which is illegal. You have to have a reasonable suspicion to believe that a person is here unlawfully.
And she sees big geographic differences. Like, she told us about some clients who live in eastern Washington state. Police there don't cooperate with ICE, but her clients work over the state line in Idaho, which is where cops pulled them over.
So they were arrested there while they were going to work in construction in a house.
Four people were in the car. One decided to just leave the country. Three of them decided to challenge their arrest.
We were honest with them and said that this could take months, you know, so and it's months of detention.
The bond hearing for the three men was the day after we spoke. So the next day when she got out of court, Andrea Lino emailed us with an update. The judge deemed her clients a flight risk. Bond denied. She wrote, "Pretty devastating for my clients and their families." She plans to continue challenging their arrest, but they'll remain locked up while their case unfolds.
This is NPR News.
President Trump is making his case for the accomplishments of his first weeks in office. What does he plan to do next? And what does Congress plan to do about it? We have analysis of the president's address to Congress on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, we'll remember a blood donor who saved more than 2 million lives.
He was known as the man with the golden arm.
And I was prepared and wanted to give something back. And I've been donating for 60 years.
Plus, New England fishermen confront climate change.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. On Capitol Hill, the House chamber is filling up as lawmakers and official Washington prepare to hear the first major speech to Congress of Donald Trump's new term as president. Mr. Trump is expected to talk about geopolitics and trade. New tariffs on robust trading partners is a big concern for consumers and businesses. NPR's Alina Selyuk tells us, for example, that Best Buy is warning of higher prices for everyone.
Best Buy CEO Corey Barry told investors the company itself imports very little directly, but it relies on a network of vendors who import about 60% of products from China and another 20% from Mexico, particularly TVs and appliances.
We expect our vendors across our entire assortment will pass along some level of tariff costs to retailers, making price increases for American consumers highly likely.
Best Buy has been one of the most outspoken companies about this. Barry has said the company has been shifting where some of its stuff comes from, but the supply chain for consumer electronics is, quote, highly global, technical, and complex. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
Federal workers' jobs are very much on the line, but comparatively, is the government truly bloated? NPR's Bill Chappell reports.
Public administration experts say the government has problems, but a bloated staff isn't one of them. Here's Max Steyer, the CEO of the nonprofit Partnership for Public Service.
The federal government is smaller proportionally than you would see in other countries. So Great Britain or Canada or Australia.
In January, the U.S. had around the same number of federal workers as it did in the late 1960s. But the U.S. now spends hundreds of billions of dollars on contractors to do government work. Experts say contractors can cost more and have less accountability. When jobs were cut in the past, demand for contractors exploded. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
The Dow lost 670 points. This is NPR. Great Lakes water levels have dropped to their lowest point in the last decade. Teresa Holmesy of member station WCMU has more.
Lakes Michigan, Huron, and Superior are all about 8 inches lower than the historical average, spanning the last 100 years. Low water levels can cause shipping vessels to run aground, limit recreational access, and increase erosion. Ricky Rood is a professor with the University of Michigan. He says climate change is resulting in extremes of both high and low lake levels in a tug-of-war trend.
Climate change has the potential to amplify the flood and the drought cycles.
The levels are expected to rise during the spring thaw. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Holmesy in Sheboygan, Michigan.
Dallas Mavericks star Kyrie Irving is out for the rest of the season. The basketball team says Irving tore the ACL in his left knee in the first quarter of his team's loss to the Sacramento Kings last night. It's another big setback for the Mavericks, who lost 10-time All-Star Anthony Davis to an injury in his debut with the Dallas team. Uber's expanding its service to self-driving cars this week in Austin, Texas. The autonomous option is offered through a partnership with robo-taxi pioneer Waymo. The service already operates in Phoenix, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, The 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump is giving a primetime address tonight to Congress. It's the first big speech since his meeting last week with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That Oval Office meeting blew up, putting a minerals deal at risk that Trump has said is key to forging a broader peace deal for the country. Yesterday, reporters asked him if the minerals deal was dead, and here's what he said.
Well, I'll let you know. We're making a speech. You probably heard about it tomorrow night, so I'll let you know tomorrow night. But no, I don't think so. I think it's a great deal for us.
So what will he say about this and other parts of his agenda tonight? For more, NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson is here in the studio. Hey, Mara.
Hi there.
Before we get to Ukraine, lay out the bigger picture of what you're expecting tonight.
You know, traditionally, these speeches have been an opportunity for presidents to command the undivided attention of tens of millions of people and lay out their agenda. But Donald Trump has already done that. He's already dominated the media narrative since he was elected. He's moved very quickly to dismantle the administrative state, to change the world order, to put in place his agenda on economic and social issues. And usually, this first address is a curtain raiser to a new presidency. But this presidency feels like it's way past that already. We're already into Act Two. So Trump has talked about just about every single thing he wants to do over and over. By one count, he's been asked and answered over 1,000 questions from the press. So this is not the debut.
Right. So what has the White House said about what this speech will be?
The White House says the theme of the speech is the renewal of the American dream. White House aides say the president is going to talk about the economy and border security and foreign policy, and immigration is going to be at the top of that list. Trump believes that the border and illegal immigration is one of the main reasons that he won. And a mainstay of all Trump's speeches at rallies or at conventions is to have people in the audience who've been victims of crimes committed by people who are in the country without legal status. And there will be some of those people there tonight. There are also going to be invited guests in the First Lady's box, and the White House describes these people as everyday Americans, but they include the family members of the firefighter who was killed during the assassination attempt on Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania in July, and he will certainly talk about that.
Besides immigration, he also spoke a lot on the campaign, and since he won, about inflation and prices. How do you think he'll address that tonight?
Well, that is a really good question, because this was one of his most politically significant promises. People voted for him because they didn't like inflation. He promised to bring prices down, and he was very explicit about it. But since he's been in office, he has backed off from those promises. He's talked about how hard it is to bring down prices. And what I'm watching for tonight is how he talks about something that he hasn't prioritized, but that we know voters are very concerned about, because polling shows more than half of Americans think Trump is not doing enough to bring down prices. We saw the Consumer Confidence Index drop in February, and his speech is happening on a day when markets are down sharply because of his new tariffs on Canada and Mexico.
And then there's Ukraine on the heels of that spectacle in the Oval Office with Zelensky. What do you expect him to say tonight?
Well, if there's any suspense at all about tonight, it's what he's going to say about Ukraine. The U.S. has just paused all military aid to Ukraine until Trump determines that Vladimir Zelensky is making a good faith effort at negotiating with the Russians. This happened, of course, after that incredible blow up that you talked about in the Oval Office. Not only did Zelensky leave the White House empty-handed that day, but Trump also was left empty-handed because he wants this deal with Ukraine on minerals to be part of his overall plan to somehow end the war in Ukraine. Trump has asked Zelensky to be more appreciative. Today we saw the Ukrainian president on social media effusively expressing gratitude towards the U.S. and Donald Trump. And the question for tonight is, will that be enough to get these negotiations back on track? And we'll see what the president says about it.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's a riddle. What does vaporizing minerals in Algeria have to do with the search for ancient life on Mars? Well, it all has to do with gypsum. Here's science reporter Ari Daniel.
In a way, it all started with a road trip about a decade ago.
My father, he had the car, so I had to borrow the car from him. Yeah, he said, yeah, let's go together.
Yusuf Salam and his father were headed north to a gypsum quarry near the Mediterranean coast of their country, Algeria. Salam says his dad had ignited in him a curiosity about the world since he was little.
The first science magazine I got, it was for my father. The first biology book, it was for my father.
Salam went on to study microbiology and paleontology. He became interested in ancient microbes and the tiny fossils they leave behind in minerals like gypsum. And then, during an internship in Italy, he was chatting with his supervisor when the stars aligned.
He said, yeah, we know almost everything about the Mediterranean, but there is a place that we couldn't go, and we would like to get some gypsum.
That place was Algeria, which is how Salam wound up driving his dad's green Toyota Echo to that quarry. Over a couple days, Salam collected more than 60 pounds of gypsum.
I was the one making the sampling. Well, my dad was just watching.
Back at the lab, Salam saw sinuous filaments preserved in the mineral, ancient fossilized microbes.
We cannot be 100% sure about the species.
They might have been a kind of algae or bacteria. Salam ultimately got into a PhD program in physics at the University of Bern in Switzerland.
He was like, okay, now we're talking.
And here's what Salam decided to tackle. You can only look back at microbial life on Earth so far. That's because plate tectonics on our planet, when it was just a baby, erased the clues of its early existence.
So basically we lost the first billion years regarding the history of the Earth, and we don't know what happened. So we have a gap.
A gap that includes any really ancient microbes. Luckily, though, there's Mars.
Mars is a screenshot of the early Earth. Of course, not exactly, but quite similar.
By studying Mars, scientists might learn about the ancient Earth. And if, and it's a big if, Mars has microbes fossilized in its gypsum, researchers will need the right tools to load onto rovers to look for that life. And that's where Salam's PhD came in, which focused on testing whether a powerful instrument about the size of a water bottle could detect the chemical signatures of life.
It's basically a laser beam hitting the sample, and this laser will vaporize part of the material, creating some atoms. You will have a spectra of the different elements that are existing in the rock,
which reveals whether there's fossilized life in the rock. But before that laser could be sent to Mars, it had to be tested on Earth, and Salam had the perfect sample, his Algerian gypsum.
We proved that our instrument is capable to detect signatures of life in the gypsum,
suggesting that one day it might help do the same on Mars. The results were published in the journal Frontiers in Astronomy and Space Sciences. Bonnie Baxter directs the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster University and wasn't involved in the research.
What this study in Algeria really does is it sort of highlights that you can use chemical methods to infer that biology is in the mineral. And chemical methods are just a little more transferable to Mars.
Still, she says, the laser approach on the red planet might be tricky because it would have to detect fossils that are billions instead of millions of years old. Yusuf Salam is proud that his first ever scientific publication highlights Algeria. But just before he finished it up, in September, his father passed away.
I wish I had my dad live in this moment. In reality, always standing with me and, yeah, maybe you would say, don't stop here. Keep going.
Advice that Salam is sure to follow. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump is imposing steep tariffs today on products that come from this country's three biggest trading partners, Mexico, Canada, and China. And those higher taxes on imports are sending shockwaves through the U.S. economy. One sector bracing for impact is the housewares industry, companies that make kitchen gadgets, travel gear, and pet supplies, as David Shaper reports from Chicago.
It's not quite outdoor grilling season here in Chicago just yet, but Paul Sierra has the products you need to get ready for it.
Our flagship product is the Q-Swiper, and it's just an easy way to clean your grill. It's like a Swiffer for your barbecue grill.
Sierra is one of 1,600 exhibitors here at the big annual Inspired Home Show, hawking products to upgrade home living.
Then we have our grill basket, which is...
Sierra would love nothing more than to chat about his grilling tools all day. But the talk here among members of the International Housewares Association inevitably turns to tariffs.
The concern is inflationary, right?
Sierra's company, Proud Grill, is Canadian and manufactures most of its products in China. and they're sold here in hardware stores.
They're going to take retail prices up in their stores. They're going to have to.
Down the row on the exhibition center floor is Jan Murtaugh, president of Portland-based CDN, which makes digital thermometers, timers, and scales for home kitchens and restaurants in many places, including Hong Kong.
Well, you know, it's already a problem with timers, that 25%, because you think of a little timer and you add 25% to that, something that shouldn't be that expensive now is.
And how might consumers react?
It gets to the point you don't want to pay. It's just too expensive and you can live without it.
The overwhelming concern here in the housewares industry is that already tight margins will be squeezed even more and sales may slow significantly.
I think it's going to make things trickier. I think we're going to have to figure out a way to maybe cut other costs.
Bill McHenry is president and founder of Widgeteer, a Chicago area company that sells glassware, woodware, and other kinds of kitchenware. I asked if he was able to stock up ahead of the tariffs.
Some of my peers that have bigger companies, like the booth next to us is over $1 billion company. They did buy extra, but I'm not that big, you know, so I don't have the financial capability of buying a bunch of stuff and holding it.
McHenry says he has some factories in countries not facing the steep tariffs and is considering moving more of his manufacturing out of China.
But the Chinese, frankly, make amazing glassware. And glassware is a big part of our business. And even with the tariffs, their costs are still better than going to India or another country.
For Doug Cohen, it's not the Trump tariffs per se.
The problem is the reciprocal tariffs.
Cohen's company, Regency Wraps, makes and sources cloth kitchen products here in the U.S.
This lemon wrap is made in Dallas, and we export it every day to Germany, to Canada, to France, all over the world.
Canada and China have already announced reciprocal tariffs on U.S. products, and others may follow suit.
I mean, the other countries are not going to absorb the tariffs. I am. And we have to pass them on, or at least a portion of them.
Cohen knows his products are not a necessity, and if the price is too high, customers won't buy them. And that could put his company and its 35 employees in Dallas in peril. For NPR News, I'm David Shaper in Chicago.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The waters off the New England coast are warmer because of climate change. That has brought in new fish and the potential for new opportunities for fishermen. But climate change is happening so fast that fishermen and regulators are falling behind. WBUR's Barbara Moran has more.
The fishing boat Paladin is off the coast of Nantucket. And on the deck, the flounder are flopping. Fisherman Bill Amaru casts a line off the side, reels in another one, and shows it off.
That's a nice fish.
Yeah. How big is that?
I'd say it'll just be a borderline large, probably about 2 pounds.
Amaru has worked as a commercial fisherman for more than 50 years. And this part of the Atlantic Ocean is a lot warmer than when he started out. Sometimes even fish from the tropics show up, like tarpon or sailfish.
Nothing is weird anymore out here. Tropical is getting to be fairly common, but I think what we're losing is way, way in excess of what we're gaining.
What scientists say New England is losing are iconic species like cod and lobster. They've shifted north or moved to deeper parts of the ocean in search of colder water.
What surprised me the most was the magnitude of the changes.
John Hare directs the Northeast Fisheries Science Center at NOAA. He says higher temperatures are not the only change in New England waters.
As carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, and then it dissolves into the ocean, and that makes the ocean more acidic. And there's also changes in ocean circulation, which are becoming more pronounced as climate change continues.
Most of these changes are harming New England fisheries. Habitats are changing, invasive pests like green crabs are arriving, and many valuable fish species are in decline. But it's not all bad news. Take black sea bass. It's a fish people want to eat, and it's expanding into New England waters. But most of the quotas and permits to catch black sea bass are reserved for fishermen in the mid-Atlantic.
What that means for us, and not having any management authority over it, is that we don't have opportunities to harvest it.
Kate O'Keefe leads the New England Fishery Management Council, which recommends catch limits, quotas, and other management measures to NOAA. She says fishermen need to be able to land the new fish that are coming in.
It's a very high priority for us right now, as we see some of our traditional stocks declining or shifting north to Canada. We want to be able to take opportunities of stocks that are shifting into our waters.
That means helping fisheries meet the challenges of climate change. To do that, the Biden administration invested hundreds of millions of dollars through the country's first major climate law. So far, President Donald Trump has not frozen those dollars for fisheries. O'Keefe says the impacts of climate change are too important to ignore. Time, she says, is running out.
My biggest worry is losing the industry. We can't wait a decade because there won't be New England fishing industries left anymore.
The fishing industry in Massachusetts, for example, generates nearly $22 billion a year and employs hundreds of thousands of people, including Bill Amaru. Back at the dock, Amaru and his crew load coolers of fish into the bed of a pickup truck, then take them to be weighed.
So that adds up to, 170 pounds.
Okay, and is that good?
That's better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. How would we put it that way?
All joking aside, for Amaru, the stakes are personal. His son and grandson are both full-time commercial fishermen. Amaru worries about their future.
The more that we disrupt the climate, it's making it very difficult to make a living on the traditional stock. The fish just are not here anymore like they were back then.
The question is whether the industry can adapt to the new fish coming in. Amaru is betting that it can. He just invested in a rare permit and a new set of traps, designed to catch black sea bass. For NPR News, I'm Barbara Moran in Boston.
The story was produced as part of the Pulitzer Center's Story Reach U.S. Fellowship. Columbia University's Doolin, too, contributed to the reporting.
One of the world's most prolific blood donors has died after saving more than 2 million lives. Australia's James Harrison gave blood and plasma more than 1,000 times throughout his life. That earned him one of the country's highest civilian honors and the nickname, the man with the golden arm. NPR's Rachel Treisman has this remembrance.
James Harrison died last month at age 88, according to Lifeblood, the branch of the Australian Red Cross responsible for blood donations. Harrison donated blood every 2 weeks for more than half a century. The organization credits him with saving the lives of 2.4 million babies. He once held the Guinness World Record for blood plasma donations and received a Medal of the Order of Australia. But he wasn't one to brag, as he told NPR in 2015.
I'm in a safe room donating blood. They give me a cup of coffee and something to nibble on, and then I just go on my way. No problem, no hardship.
For Harrison, giving blood started as a way to give back. When he was 14, he had surgery to remove a lung. The process involved months in the hospital and multiple blood transfusions, almost 2 gallons worth. He was inspired to return the favor.
I was always looking forward to donating right from the operation, because I don't know how many people that took to save my life, but I never met them, didn't know them.
Harrison started giving blood regularly as soon as he turned 18. That was in 1954. A decade later, he found himself at the center of a medical breakthrough. Researchers had been seeking treatment for a potentially fatal condition called hemolytic disease of the newborn. That's when a pregnant person's blood type is incompatible with their baby's, causing their immune system to attack the fetus. In the 1960s, scientists discovered a rare, life-saving antibody called anti-D, and it turned out Harrison had plenty of it, likely as a result of his childhood transfusions.
And I was prepared and wanted to give something back, and I've been donating for 60 years.
Harrison became Australia's first and most prolific anti-D donor. Lifeblood, the blood donation agency, says he rolled up his sleeve a total of 1,173 times, never missing an appointment or expecting anything in return. Blood donors don't get paid under Australian law. Harrison's recipients include his own daughter, Tracy Mellowship. She said her family, quote, may not have existed without his precious donations. And they, too, paid it forward.
The whole family of blood donors, and that makes you feel proud, too.
Anti-D donations are relatively rare. Lifeblood says Australia has fewer than 200 regular donors who help tens of thousands of mothers and babies annually. Australian researchers are working to create a synthetic version of the antibody using blood from Harrison and other donors. They're calling the project James in a Jar, and it could see Harrison helping to save lives long after his death. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at Progressive.com/careers. And from